This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Watching your workplace slow down or seeing Michigan's colleges and universities switch to distance learning, these are the things that you might expect during a major public health incident. What about the wheels of justice? Think about it. All the criminal matters, all the restraining orders, bankruptcy filings, child custody cases that might be interrupted. The Michigan Judicial Branch has sent out guidance to state courts that are making decisions about whether to stay open, shut down some operations, or perhaps call a hiatus altogether. Bridget McCormick is the Chief Justice of the Michigan Supreme Court, and she joins us now with more. Justice McCormick, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What kind of circumstances have closed courts in Michigan in recent history? There must be some precedent for this, right?
There is a little bit that I'm aware of. Last winter, when a lot of state government shut down, when the governor called a state of emergency because of the severely low temperatures, a number of courthouses in the state decided to close, including the Michigan Supreme Court. Not all did, because we have a non-unified court system. Each local court has to work with its local funding unit. And so for some, the decision was easy. If your employees are all county employees and the county is closed, you're likely to be closed. But for some who have different relationships, they were able to stay open or at least keep some functions open.
Just as with a weather emergency, I imagine that there may be some differences with what's going on in more populated areas of the state and courts in the Upper Peninsula that are much smaller operations.
So that's exactly right. I just finished a meeting with the leaders of all the judicial associations, the probate judges, the district judges, and the circuit court judges all have leadership, and I met with all of them. And, you know, the different courts face different issues when you have a weather crisis, but also a public health crisis like the one we're facing now. There are some Upper Peninsula courts that have very, very few people in and out of them, and it might not be hard to keep doing business as usual. And then we have some incredibly busy district courts where you will have large numbers of people waiting in the lobby on any given day, and they're facing a different set of problems.
You and the State Court Administrative Office are working on a COVID-19 response plan right now. What kind of things are you taking into consideration?
So right now, what we're trying to do is make sure that the judges throughout the state and the court administrators throughout the state have access to all of the best information, ideas, recommendations. So we put up on the Michigan Supreme Court website a webpage devoted to all of these resources. It, of course, links to the State of Michigan page, as well as the National Center for State Courts page and the CDC. But also, we are going to be adding to it other ideas, advice, plans that come to our attention, so people have one place to go for information. I also sent out a set of recommendations for courts to think about. And again, because each court has its own relationship with its funding unit, its own public health officials, we understand that different courts will be making different decisions, at least for now. But we thought it was important to send out general recommendations, docket management recommendations.
What are the general recommendations? Like, what kinds of things are you telling them?
So the things we told them, even before the governor declared a state of emergency, was that that they should be establishing communication with their funding unit and their county health department immediately, that they should be following the CDC's advice, that they should be identifying work-related exposure and health risks to employees. They should be identifying their essential employees and what equipment they might need in the event of a state of an emergency, which we're now in. In terms of docket management, we recommended that they start consider adjourning hearings with vulnerable persons, including, of course, people who are 60 and over and at risk, especially if they're already medically compromised, adult guardianship proceedings in particular, and to start planning for remote hearings in as many cases as possible, including arraignments, mental health trials, guardian ad litem proceedings. When the governor declared a state of emergency, we took it up a notch. We recommended they consider adjourning civil jury trials, as well as criminal jury trials when the defendant is not in custody. And frankly, even when the defendant is in custody, some jurisdictions are going to have to make hard decisions about which cases can be adjourned. The jurors are innocent, and it is irresponsible for us to be calling in hundreds of jurors and putting them in a small room together at this time.
Right. Do all of Michigan's courts have the capacity to hold remote hearings?
Yes, we do. And thank goodness, a number of years ago, the Supreme Court made video conferencing. We put video conferencing technology in every court in the state. So we do have the ability to do a whole lot by video.
When we talk about workplaces, we're using phrases like non-essential personnel and operations. When I think about what happens in the courts, a whole lot of it seems important, or else it would not be coming before a court. How do you prioritize?
Yeah, that's true. What I said to folks was we need to be focused on three fundamental obligations, and the first one is protecting the health of the litigants and the employees of our courts, but also the public that shows up to use the facilities, including jurors, but also maintaining critical judicial branch functions. Courts are part of our public safety system, so they can't just shut down altogether. We also want to make sure that we're providing appropriate judicial input into the process of protecting the public more generally. So we want to be involved in the conversations that the governor is having with her directors as well. But within our courthouses, there are apples and oranges. I mean, there are cases that must be heard because critical public safety questions are at stake. And there are cases that can wait. Like I said, and like I recommended, civil jury trials, in most cases, can wait. Criminal jury trials where somebody's not in custody can wait. So there's a way to think about which cases we can return to in a month or two when we know better what we're dealing with.
Have any Michigan courts yet needed to decide any questions about mandatory testing or treatment?
Not that I'm aware of, and I believe I would be, because we've asked our judges to make sure they communicate with our regional administrators so that we get that information. But I am not aware of any so far.
Do you think it might come to that?
I assume so. I mean, it's hard to predict what I feel like everything changes hour by hour right now. I saw the Big Ten tournament just got canceled while it was about to start. I'm assuming there'll be a lot of important, hard questions coming to Michigan's judges.
I was looking over a guidebook that's recommended for state courts as they think through their pandemic preparedness. I guess I shouldn't have been surprised that it began with several sections on the role of federal and state government and public health law explanations. Can courts react in a timely fashion to developing public health emergencies?
I believe they can. Like a lot of government, sometimes we're not as nimble as the private sector, but I am confident in my senior team and the state court administrative office's ability to make sure we can be in constant communication with the judges throughout the state. And we have tremendous judges and court staff and court administrators ready to respond to whatever's at stake. So I think we can.
Just one last question. What does Michigan need to think about for its courts if this ends up lasting longer than a couple of weeks?
Like everyone else, courts are places where lots of people gather. And from what we know right now, the only thing we can be doing, since there is no vaccine and there is no treatment for this particular virus, is doing everything we can to slow the spread so we do not burden our medical centers and we save as many lives as possible. So I think what courts need to be doing right now is thinking about how to contribute to solving that problem. We can figure out the court's business going forward. We're all prepared to work hard and work long hours to catch up on what needs to be caught up for now. We want to be part of the solution here in Michigan.
Chief Justice Bridget McCormick of the Michigan Supreme Court. Justice McCormick, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You guys, court is not the only thing closing because of the coronavirus. I have news.
This year, with a heavy heart, we are canceling or postponing the 49th annual Hash Bash.
Nick Zittel of the organizing team for the 49th annual Hash Bash in Ann Arbor says the event is postponed. It was scheduled for Saturday, April 4th at wait for it, high noon on the U of M's Diag. Hash Bash has its roots in the city's counterculture of the 60s, when John Sinclair was arrested for giving out a couple of joints. But the risks this year, they're just too great.
We're looking at different alternatives for different dates in the fall, but also just trying to take this as an opportunity to really gear up for next year, which will actually be the 50th annual Ann Arbor Hash Bash.
On the upside, I guess if this whole thing blows over relatively quickly, there's always the chance that Hash Bash could be rescheduled for April 20th. Zatel also says people should take precautions if they do use cannabis.
If you are a social smoker, consider carrying your own pipe or rolling your own joint. Or there are some different devices for different pipes and bongs that help consumers kind of keep it to themselves. So it's worth looking into some of those. And try to be safe and sensible.
In other news, WWE's Friday Night SmackDown in Detroit at the Little Caesars Arena will go forward as planned this weekend. Let's be safe out there. Coming up, if you're ready to throw your smartphone out the car window and adopt a simpler, tech-free life, it might surprise you to know even the Amish do sometimes make judicious use of tech.
Their huge determinants are, how will this affect our family? How will this affect our relationships with our brothers and sisters in our community? And of course, how do we feel this, you know, interacts with our faith?
That's next on Stateside. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. It may be that by this point in the day, you're more than ready to turn off your phone. It's so hard to look away when breaking news is happening, but maybe we can all agree we should feel free to make less frequent use of technology. Maybe you even have daydreams about joining an Amish community somewhere and just switching off. Would it surprise you to know even the Amish use some tech? Michigander Jeff Smith is the author of Becoming Amish, A Family Search for Faith, Community, and Purpose. And he recently wrote an essay about this in the Washington Post. Jeff Smith, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that the Amish do use some tech. How did you become aware of how this works?
Well, let's see. A guy that I grew up with, I met him when I was 4 years old in Livonia, and we were best friends throughout life, and I was best man in his wedding, and he was best man in my wedding. And but then about in our mid-30s, he and his wife kind of headed off on a journey of faith and ended up becoming Amish. And so at the time, I ended up being editor of Traverse Magazine. I wrote a story about them. And as I kind of learned more about their life and the choices that they make and their community makes, that eventually evolved into a book about their journey. So
tell us about some of the ways that Amish families sometimes make the decision to embrace technology. Could you give us some examples and sort of tell us how they make their decisions?
So I think one of the most unexpected things about the Amish, at least for me, but also when people talk to me about my book and I present, is that there's actually quite a diversity of technology rules within the broad Amish community. And for example, you might have communities where the members are not even allowed to put a rubber tire around their steel wheel on their buggy, for example. And that would be, you know, on the really more low-tech scale. But on the other end of the scale, you might have communities that allow their members to drive diesel-powered tractors and then maybe even take that a step further, and they might be allowed to drive that tractor to church with their family, you know, in the back.
When we say allowed, maybe it's a good time that we unpack sort of how these decisions are made. I mean, what is the hierarchy within Amish communities?
The Amish communities are made up of about 30 people, and each of those church groups gets to decide the rules of their technology acceptance. And, you know, largely they would adhere to kind of a broad Amish philosophy, but as, you know, as I've just indicated, there is some real latitude within that. And so when they are presented with choices about technology, their huge determinants are, how will this affect our family? How will this affect our relationships with our brothers and sisters in our community? And of course, how do we feel this, you know, interacts with our faith? And so they would have a conversation about that. They would vote on it. It's not like a decree from on high, really. It's a very communal kind of structure. And of course, that's going to vary among communities based on the personalities involved and the strength of, you know, the bishop or whatever. But that's how it's, you know, supposed to work, basically. One example I mentioned in the Washington Post essay, I think, is one of my favorites, where a guy in my friend's community wanted to buy a hay baler that allowed him to bale hay alone. So he would no longer need his friends to come and help him bale hay. And I think he might have had kind of a health issue or something that was driving this. But anyway, so they talked about this as a community, like, how will that affect our community and our ties with one another if this guy is over here just baling hay all by himself? And it's no longer, hey, we're all here with you and we're helping you and we're helping one another. And so they really talked this all through, and it's kind of a big thing. And so what they decided, and again, I think it was in part because of this health issue, is he was allowed to go ahead and get this baler, but nobody else used it. And so they all kept, you know, gathering and doing this work. Another example that I liked was in a family wanted to run propane gas lines to all the rooms of their home so they could have lights in the bedroom, say. And so as opposed to just having propane in the main gathering areas like the kitchen, dining room, living room. And so the conversation there was, well, if we allow this, then everyone's going to go to their bedrooms and read alone versus gathering in the living room to read together. And I think, you know, as we hear these kind of stories, you know, it makes sense intellectually, but I think even more important, we kind of feel it in our heart, right? Like when you think, oh, I'm gathering in my living room with my kids and we're all reading together, like, you feel that in your heart. And I think that really says something about our human condition and how this stuff is really legit to think about and be super intentional about.
Well, it feels like a situation that could have happened in almost literally any American family, the only difference being that the Amish actually talk about it as it's happening.
Yes, right. They're very intentional instead of just allowing it to happen. You're absolutely right. And that is, and honestly, that's the whole point of the essay. Let's be intentional about this. Let's not just sort of allow tech to creep in and do its thing. And all of a sudden we're standing there going, wow, what happened? You know, my family is no longer looking at each other, all looking at their phone at dinner time, you know, and stuff like that. So intentionality is kind of the big message. Yeah.
Even with all this thought and intention, I mean, Amish families are not, you know, they're still just American families.
Absolutely.
Are there ways that they sometimes get drawn in as all the rest of us do in ways that decrease connection or that they maybe came to regret later?
You know, I would say I'm sure there are. There just have to be. And we've probably all seen maybe pictures on the internet or something where Amish girls are looking at their phones or something like that, you know? And so I have no doubt that they do. But I think, you know, speaking broadly about them, the incidence of that is probably less. And but yes, they, I'm really glad you brought that up, though. They're humans. They struggle with all the same things, and I'm sure they get pulled into it as we do.
I was very interested to read that there are other factors than technology that pose challenges to the Amish as they try to stay true to who they are, even as their numbers are increasing. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is simply trying to make a living. And that that all gets back to technology as well. And while they are very supportive of one another in their businesses and in their farming and all that, they still have to deal with the fact that it takes them way longer to harvest corn than just, you know, going through the huge combine or whatever. And that's just a very real thing when it comes to price and labor and all that. So there has been a steady migration off the farm. And so that migration to new things like manufacturing and retail and all these other things, you know, they have to interact with the world a lot more, and that presents a challenge. It is a fundamental principle of Amish to remain separate. Like, that's not just sort of an accidental thing or we kind of like it this way thing. That is a very central tenet of their belief that we shall remain separate from the broader world. And so as they migrate into that world to have to make a living, basically, you know, that does present challenges for them. But I think it's really interesting that despite that increased interaction with a bigger world, the percentage of people who stay Amish, who have been raised Amish, remains relatively stable and is actually quite high. Like, it is around 90%.
Even as technology makes further and further inroads into society, you're saying that they've been able to hold their own.
Yeah, which is very surprising, really, I think anyway, yeah.
Is there anything that you've embraced in your life after seeing how they employ this more considered approach to technology and the ways that life is changing?
Well, I think where it's mostly affected me is, one, just being aware of that, you know, being aware of the influence of technology. Okay, like, here's maybe a silly example, but we got a Nest controller for our heat, you know, in our home recently, and you can control that with your phone, okay? So you no longer have to stand up and walk across the room and change the temperature control, you know? And
on the thermostat.
On the thermostat, right. So I'm like, do I want to do that? Or am I okay still having to expend that energy and stand up and go over there? You know, it's like, is this an erosion of my physicality or something, you know? But I mean, that's just a simple, silly little example. I think, honestly, for me, the bigger thing is more being intentional about my interactions with people. And I think that's a big point of the essay, is the solutions, they don't have to come from, like, the government or Facebook. We don't need to wait for them to change how they're separating us and all that. We are empowered to sort of blunt this technology attack, if you want to call it that, by simply gathering more and being aware of how often we get together with friends and how often we visit, say, elders in our family, or, you know, have a potluck or whatever. And so that, my reaction has been a little more like that, like, not so much to reject a bunch of technology, but just be sort of always aware of how it's affecting me. So this isn't just like a small, cute, quaint thing. This is like, it's truly affecting the very fabric of our social networks, and it's affecting our health. And I guess the point of that essay is, as we grapple with all of that, we have the antidote. It's just an ancient thing. The antidote is ancient. It is just gathering with people we love, or, you know, our neighbors, and just making sure we interact in those ways. And it's actually extremely powerful, and it has sustained us through our entire history. And so I think that's the main takeaway.
Jeff Smith is the author of Becoming Amish, A Family Safe for Faith, Community, and Purpose. You can find a link to his recent essay from the Washington Post at our website. Very few correspondents have put as many miles on their shoes over the past couple election cycles as Tim Alberta, now chief political correspondent for Politico. He's worked for the National Review, the Wall Street Journal, and others, and his book, American Carnage, a New York Times bestseller, was one of the most widely read accounts of the 2016 election cycle and the rise of Donald Trump. He lives and works in Michigan. Tim Alberto, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
This little article you published in 2016 in the National Review, looking at the Michigan primaries results and modestly proposing, don't write off this real estate developer and reality TV star named Trump too soon. What was it like to be right?
Oh my gosh, I don't think I've ever been asked that, certainly not by my wife or any loved ones. What was it like to be right? You know, it's interesting because I can't, I will hang my hat on that one article. But like so many other people, I think there were other just fundamentally important things that I missed along the way in 2016. So I don't want to tip my, I don't want to puff out my chest too much.
Well, you said at the end of the article that you didn't think Trump would carry Michigan.
Close the deal.
Which turned out to be something he did by 10,000 votes.
By 10,000 votes, right. And really, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, those three by a combined 77,744 votes. I mean, that's the difference between a Clinton presidency and a Trump presidency. But, you know, looking at that one article you mentioned, yeah, I was right in just seeing how, you know, March 8th, 2016 was such an interesting day with that Michigan Republican primary that Trump won, with the Democratic primary that Sanders obviously won. And sort of if you took the maps, the result maps of those two primaries and sort of overlaid them on the November general election map, it was just uncanny how similar it was. And the dynamics you saw sort of driving those two primaries, and specifically on the Democratic side, looking at depressed turnout, looking at a lack of energy among African-American voters for Hillary Clinton, looking at her getting really demolished among independents and getting beaten badly among white working class voters in exurban and rural parts of the state, those were sort of flashing red lights for her campaign. And her campaign, you know, essentially refused to acknowledge them, not just in Michigan, but we saw them in other places. We saw it in the Philadelphia suburbs. We saw it in the city of Philadelphia itself. We saw it in Milwaukee and metropolitan Milwaukee. And obviously, we focus a lot on those three states, but we saw it in other places around the country as well. I think what was so clear walking out of that 2016 Democratic primary was not that Bernie Sanders was some force of nature, but that Hillary Clinton was a deeply flawed Democratic nominee in waiting, and that if she didn't do something dramatic to address those vulnerabilities, that she could lose a state like this. And obviously at the time, a lot of people sort of rolled their eyes at that. I don't think I've ever gotten so much hate mail after writing a piece. Everybody said, you must be crazy. There's just no way. It's part of the blue wall. Democrats haven't lost the state since 1988. But sure enough, she just didn't do enough to address those vulnerabilities. And Trump, you know, I think in many ways was sort of ideally positioned to exploit them.
You've come 4 years later right back around to the Michigan primary in a piece that came up this week looking at Bernie Sanders and Michigan. And, you know, that 2016 primary victory, you point out that Bernie loyalists looked at what happened in the 2016 cycle with Bernie Sanders stealing Michigan away from Hillary Clinton, saying, Bernie's on fire. This is huge. And then more moderate party members looked at the exact same results and said, good Lord, turnout was low.
Mm-hmm. You know, we focused so much in the 2016 cycle on white working class voters and their disillusionment with the party. We focused a lot on African-American voters and how they just were not energized by a Hillary Clinton candidacy after 8 years of Barack Obama. The one group we didn't talk a lot about was wealthy, upscale suburbanites, and specifically suburban women, college-educated moms in Oakland County and in parts of Macomb and Livingston counties and on the west side of the state in Kent County. How are they voting? How are they responding? And if the 2018 midterm elections were any indicator, the Democratic Party in Michigan has a real reason to feel hopeful because, you know, what you saw with the victories of Gretchen Whitmer as governor, Alyssa Slotkin in the 8th District, Haley Stevens in the 11th District, those were victories that really came in no small part on the strength of a big spike in voting and in turnout among those suburban women in areas that have not been friendly to Democrats traditionally. And so if you continue to see that in 2020, and it's a big if, I mean, midterm voting behavior patterns are much different than general election behaviors. But if you see a sustained enthusiasm among those suburban, affluent, college-educated, two-car garage households, and particularly the moms there, then it's suddenly coalition, politics being a coalition business, it suddenly becomes very difficult to see how Donald Trump could overcome all of those demographics working against him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for the website Politico. In a moment, we'll have more of our conversation, including how Democrats won some Republican districts in the 2018 midterms.
They recruited all of these very disciplined candidates who ran right down the middle, and they were able to appeal to districts that are increasingly purple. The question is, can Republicans do the same thing?
That's coming up after the break. This is Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for the website Politico and author of American Carnage. He's also a native of Michigan and recently moved back here after spending years covering Congress and presidential campaigns for the National Review, the Wall Street Journal, and other publications. Let's listen to more of our conversation about the 2020 political landscape. All this soul searching that's been going on the Democratic side has really challenged the notion that the Democratic Party would have to rely on the same old voting blocks. You know, what if Bernie Sanders was right to an extent that the future lies with younger voters? You know, could it be that Latinos can be brought in around to a party's nominee eventually? Maybe the Democrats are thinking that they don't have to rely on the same old voters or older voters. Is the Republican Party even close to having a conversation like that right now?
Oh, the irony here is Shakespearean, because they were very close to having that conversation. In fact, they were having that conversation after the 2012 election. You know, when Barack Obama was reelected, Mitt Romney, the Republican nominee that year, he won just 17% of non-white voters. He won only 27% of Hispanic voters. And the demographic writing seemed to be on the wall for the GOP at that point. And what ensued was basically a year-long soul-searching process in which the party, in a very rare public way, sort of acknowledged its own vulnerabilities and its blind spots and frankly, some of its sort of more overtly xenophobic tendencies in driving away some of these voters. And it really seemed like the party, I mean, even people like Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, some of the hardliners, were coming around to this idea that, you know, we cannot attempt to just win presidential elections on the backs of white voters. Like, the math doesn't work. And then Donald Trump comes along and blows
that
up.
Sweeps it away. People love to call it a fractious and protracted primary, but there was some stuff getting figured out there.
There was. Yeah, there was. And look, honestly, as counterintuitive as it may seem, parties traditionally, you know, historically speaking, political parties tend to do their best work when they're in the minority, when they're out of power, because they sort of have the space and the time to figure some of that stuff out.
Nobody's paying attention.
And you can sort of tear it down and rebuild it, right? Just like a bad sports franchise, not that we have any of those in Michigan. and I think it's so important to recognize that, you know, Donald, I mentioned Shakespeare a minute ago. I mean, the guy who was heading up that whole project for the Republican Party was Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican Party. And he was the one saying to anybody who would listen, look, the math here doesn't work. We can't win elections this way. And then he becomes White House chief of staff to the guy who crumpled up that plan and threw it in a waste paper basket.
You detail all of this in American Carnage, this detailed story about how at first everybody in the GOP, most of the people in the GOP were considering Trump a joke, but ultimately they found his candidacy and his presidency extremely useful. Sure, you get the overt appeals to white nationalists, rejection of not just science, but certain accepted facts that the rest of Washington takes for granted. But you also get tax cuts and a hard line on social issues and maybe a wedge to blue collar voters through trade policies and all the judicial nominations that any conservative could hope for. Do you see the party ever getting to the point of deciding that this president causes more problems than he solves? Or is that deal just like still working out for them?
I think it's still working out for most of them. No question. And you know, I've had these conversations with Republican voters that range from, you know, sort of low income, low education levels, you know, people who are you know, living in sort of isolated rural areas and who really love the president, all the way to people who are, you know, millionaires and very wealthy and successful with multiple degrees on the wall. And the one thing that they will sort of tell you is, look, If you were to put on a blindfold and just sort of look at the accomplishments, forget about the Twitter feed, forget about the rhetoric, forget about a lot of the strange behavior, but if you were just to look at the results And if you want to view politics and government as a results-oriented business, then these are pretty good, and we would take them, right? And that is, I think, the fundamental question for a lot of moderate Republicans, sort of center-right Republicans this November, because they do like the results. They do think the economy is doing better than it was 4 years ago. They do feel like a lot of the deregulatory measures and other things that the administration has done have contributed to not just an economy that's better, but to sort of a general sense of confidence in the country and among consumers and everything else, and they like that. And yet, there's this other thing. There's this elephant in the room. There's this cloud hanging over them, whatever bad cliche you want to use, where they feel like this isn't quite right. And
You mean the strange behavior and instability?
Yes.
Of the president.
Yeah. You know, and you'll talk to voters about, you know, the chance at rallies, you know, that sort of play to some of that white nationalism and the president's Twitter feed, which is seemingly creating crises where none necessarily exist. And that's the stuff that they're uncomfortable with. And socially, especially for those more upscale Republicans at the one end of the spectrum, you know, there's a bit of a sort of class consciousness involved in this, right? Like you don't want to be a social pariah for saying that you still support this president.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Alberta. He's chief political correspondent for Politico and the author of American Carnage. I guess the real issue is whether the Democratic Party has an answer as a counter to all those results coming out of primaries in Michigan and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And look, this is, I think in so many ways, this Democratic primary was a really good proxy to figure out not just where the party is today, but where it's going to be over the, you know, sort of medium and long haul. Joe Biden in Michigan said something very, very interesting. He was at Renaissance High School in Detroit, and he talked about being a bridge to the next generation of Democrats, which is an unusual thing for a, you know, a potential nominee of a party to say.
I mean, it's acknowledging he's the old dude in the room.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And not just the old dude in the room, but all, which he is, but also the guy who is not nearly as far to the left as some of the activists in his party's base are, and certainly not as far to the left as most of the other candidates in this race were. And he's saying, look, you know, this is a sort of trajectory that we're on here, but we're not going to get all the way there. I mean, Barack Obama used to talk about this all the time. And so Joe Biden, I've got to think, is emerging in about as strong a position as he could, given the fact that you just had this historically large primary field, given how divisive things were at various points in the campaign, given just how divided the party's base has been between the progressive wing and the more centrist sort of governing wing, Joe Biden has a chance here over the next week or two to really kind of put this thing away and become the de facto nominee. And for all of his manifest flaws as a candidate, and he does have plenty of them, I think Biden is probably the least threatening candidate to a lot of those voters, particularly those sort of center-right suburban voters that we've spent so much time talking about. And if you believe that that is the critical swing group here that could move en masse from one candidate to the other, then I think Joe Biden is a better candidate to reach them than Bernie Sanders is or Elizabeth Warren or any of these other Democrats.
You noted that Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens' wins really kind of paved the way for some of the cross currents in the race this year. These are both Democrats who ran right down the middle and managed to ride a wave of sort of protest against what's been going on in Washington to take over Republican seats. How do you like their chances this year?
Boy, it's such a great question, and I don't know if there are more interesting members of Congress in the country to watch than those two, you know, in terms of sort of proxies for where the environment was in 18 and then where it will be in 2020. You know, Oakland County and Livingston County, these are just great places to test this theory that it's really these, you know, affluent suburban areas that are home to the new swing voter. I mean, for decades, we've talked about swing voters being the second shift worker up to his elbows in grease at the diner, and those people just really aren't swing voters
Reagan
anymore.
Democrats.
The Reagan Democrats, right, yeah. In Macomb County, and really the conversation now has to shift to Oakland and Livingston. These are the places to watch. And so, look, if Alyssa Slotkin and Haley Stevens can run perfect campaigns then the I think the sort of power of incumbency will give them a real chance to hold on to those seats. And I think the fact that the party looks, for all intents and purposes, at this point, like it's going to nominate Joe Biden, I think that that is also helpful to them. I think it would have been very difficult for these women to thread the needle with a Bernie Sanders at the top of the ticket. That being said, when turnout really juices up in a general election year, and especially in the case of Slotkin, this is somebody who does represent a district that is just fundamentally right of center. And so it's she's going to have some inherent headwinds in an environment like this.
Who knows what's going to happen in August, but I've got to wonder if the Republican Party, as it exists with Donald Trump at the head of the ticket, can produce a moderate candidate who could counter their constant efforts just to position themselves as apolitical at the center of everything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and look, what's so interesting is when you had this wave environment in 2018 where, and the funny thing is, if you talk to the average voter and you ask them, hey, how did Democrats take back the House in 2018? Was it on the strength of an unabashedly progressive message that resonated nationwide, talking about impeaching the president, talking about Medicare for all, talking about abolishing ICE, or was it one on the strength of a bunch of moderate Democratic candidates who basically, in many cases, sounded like moderate Republicans, talking about balancing the budget, talking in some cases about protecting gun rights, talking about wanting to restore bipartisanship to Washington? 8 out of 10 people you talk to on the street would say, oh, it was the first. It was the AOC crowd, the squad. And that's just not right. I mean, Democrats had such a great year because of what you said. They recruited all of these very disciplined candidates who ran right down the middle, and they were able to appeal to districts that are increasingly purple. The question is, can Republicans do the same thing? Will they be smart and disciplined enough to recognize that the best way to try and win those districts back is not to overreach, but to try and mimic, in part, some of those successful playbooks that were run by Democrats?
You are that rare and marvelous unicorn of a politics reporter whose writing relies less on polls and more on primary results and interviews. But at the same time, political polling firms have been swearing up, down, and sideways. They've made improvements, and that we may be able to trust what they have to say about the national campaigns this year. How do you decide whether to trust a poll?
You know, oh gosh, that's another great question. I will start with by prefacing that I don't trust most polls to begin with. So they it's almost like they don't have the benefit of the doubt. I will look at a lot of polling, and there are certain indicators I'll look for. So the first is going to be, and this is less of an indicator than just something you know if you live in this world, but the reputation of the pollster themselves and whether there's somebody who is sort of competent and diligent and really exhaustive in the work they do. But then you have to start with looking at the sample size. You know, there are polls that will come out that are taken of 250 or 300 or 400 voters, and that's just typically not a big enough sample size for you to really draw any meaningful conclusions from, especially when you start looking in the crosstabs trying to figure out how certain demographic groups are going to vote. If you've got a poll with a sample size of 350 and you want to know how suburban women with a college degree are voting and there's only, 39 of them in the survey, that just doesn't help you at all. So what we saw in 2016 in Michigan and in Wisconsin, a little bit less in Pennsylvania, but there was still a problem there. It's not just that the polls were off, it's that they were wildly off. I mean, you had polling 2 weeks before the election in Michigan that showed Donald Trump polling at 33%, right? And I think the obvious conclusion for anybody with a brain who saw that was to say, well, this guy doesn't stand a chance, right? I mean, because that would just defy all history. We've never seen anybody with numbers like that even be competitive, much less win. And obviously, it was hard to quantify for pollsters just how unpopular both of these people were and how many voters were still undecided and how many voters might just stay home altogether. It's a long way of saying that pollsters have an incredibly difficult job, and I think it's valuable what they try to do. But now more than ever, I think folks in my profession really have to rely on a whole host of different metrics to sort of inform the way we report on this, not just look at the polling.
Preferably not involving landlines.
Yes, landlines are bad.
Tim, before you go, can you tell us about some of the places you've spent time since last fall that maybe were new to you or you thought were especially interesting?
Gosh, sure. Yeah, I can. Let's see. So I had a pretty memorable visit just recently to Columbus, Ohio. We were talking a bit about this before I came on the air, near and dear to your heart.
Well, that's a town that's changed so much. It has become the locus of political activity in the state as its population's ballooned above a million. And yeah, it's just, it's so much a photograph of what's going on in both the Republican and the Democratic parties right now.
Absolutely. And we were talking a bit about this realignment, this grand realignment that's happening in the age of Trump. And yeah, Columbus gives you a nice window into that. I happen to be spending time there with a bunch of young Democratic socialists and trying to have some conversations with them about not just the Bernie Sanders campaign, but about, you know, their mission much more broadly. And it was really interesting to learn about how they see the world, how they see the economy, and what they're trying to do in their communities that really falls outside of the boundaries of electoral politics. You know, I've spent time in South Florida talking with Cuban voters about, and obviously there is a tendency at times to view the Hispanic voting population as a monolith, but voters in California who are of Latino descent are just so different than voters in South Florida of Latino descent. So that's a really interesting thing that you can really sink your teeth into as a reporter and dive into.
Cuban Americans have been a stalwart of the Florida Republican Party. How are they feeling about Donald Trump?
You know, so there's a former congressman, Carlos Curbelo, who was defeated in 2018, and he was one of these sort of shining stars, a guy with an incredibly bright future from South Florida, and he lost his seat in 2018. And he lost his seat because despite the fact that he was extremely popular in his district, he was 15 or 20 points above water in all of the polling that was done down there. Donald Trump was 15 or 20 points below water in all the polling and essentially washed it out and made him vulnerable, and he lost in a pretty close election. And I've talked to him a few times about this, and he said, look, at the end of the day, you know, there are a lot of folks in a community like the Cuban community who have real sort of core cultural and social values that Trump offends, right? And for them, what's difficult is that on the one hand, Trump sort of offends them and repels them and makes them wonder how they could ever support this guy. But then some of what they see come out of the Democratic Party, they almost feel like they are voters without a country, right? Men and women without a country. And what's interesting, coming back to completely beat this thing to death with the suburban women, is all over the country, April, for the last couple of years, including those 2018 midterms, I've been in dozens of states, in dozens of congressional districts, and it's the same thing over and over and over again. You'll hear talking to these voters that, gosh, I would love to find a compelling reason to vote against Donald Trump, but some of these Democrats just scare the life out of me. And you just wonder if ultimately, when folks find themselves in the booth in 2018, whether Joe Biden will have given them sufficient confidence to go ahead and pull the lever for him, or whether whether the Trump campaign does a really effective job of tying Biden to the rest of the Democratic Party and to some of those more progressive policies that the vice president has sort of distanced himself from.
Tim Alberta, Chief Political Correspondent for Politico. Thank you so much for talking with us. And I can't wait to read what else you're working on this year.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. The stateside producers are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, and Mercedes Mejia. Our intern is Catherine Nguyen. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today is Joe's last day with the show. He's headed back home to Minnesota. He spent 4 years making the show better, and we will miss him dearly. And seriously, who else is going to prank us with fictional last-minute bookings for interview subjects in 15 minutes like the complete works of Elmore Leonard? Ready to go? Don't be a stranger, Joe. May the mitten remain in your heart. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening.